to our second episode. This is Eurasia Chat Podcast with your hosts
Joanna Lelis
and Aygerim Tolyukhanova. Today we're joined by our Central Asia editor Peter Leonard. Subscribe at Eurasianet. It's been another busy week in Central Asia. Tens of thousands of Russian citizens arrived to Kazakhstan and other Central Asian countries. There was a protest of Xinjiang activists in Almaty. And we also continue with ongoing developments about the Kyrgyzstan-Tajikistan border issue. So let's start with the Russian influx into Central Asia. Joanna, what do you know? How many people have come to Kazakhstan and why they're coming? Who are they? What are their motivations?
Indeed, there's certainly been a very large influx of Russians into Central Asia over recent days, ever since basically Vladimir Putin announced mobilization in Russia. For men to go and fight in Ukraine. And that has really led to an exodus to Central Asia, and of course to other countries as well, including countries in the Caucasus. So, what do we know about this? Certainly we've seen scenes from the borders between Russia and Kazakhstan of enormous queues of cars and people trying to cross those borders and waiting for hours and hours to cross. At times people have talked of queues of cars of about 20 kilometers. Some people have talked of waiting for maybe 7 hours or so in order to cross that border.
Do we know how many people have come to Kazakhstan?
In terms of numbers of Russian citizens who've been arriving in Kazakhstan, on the 27th of September, the government released figures showing that 98,000 Russians had crossed into the country since the 21st of September. So that's a pretty large number. The government has been at pains to stress that not all of these people are actually staying in Kazakhstan. Some of them will be using it as a springboard to move on to other places. And the government did, in fact, say when it released those figures that about 65,000 of those had actually left the country, or 65,000 Russians had left the country in that period. Now, we should bear in mind that there's a lot of toing and froing across that border at any time. Russians are coming in, Kazakhs are leaving for Russia. People are moving across the border for business and for to visit relatives at all times. This does, of course, seem like quite a large number for such a few days. So certainly it's not just about the numbers that the government has released, but also, the sort of anecdotal evidence of many people wandering around cities of Kazakhstan, especially in northern Kazakhstan, being unable to find somewhere to sleep because all the accommodation is full. And I think that was best exemplified by the news that a cinema in the northwestern city of Oralsk, very close to the Russian border, had opened its doors to allow Russians into shelter in that cinema because there was nowhere to stay. And in fact, the accommodation problem has reached as far as Astana, which is pretty far from the Russian border, the capital, and even Almaty. There are big shortages of hotel rooms and flats.
What do we know about the people who are coming? Who are they and what are their motivations?
Well, it's a good point. It's a good question to ask because I think what we're really seeing is that these are different people to the people who started to arrive in Central Asia after Russia invaded Ukraine in February, and people coming in sort of February, March, in springtime. So we saw people coming who are able to move over to Kazakhstan and other countries in Central Asia, but still continue their work and continue to earn money. I think the difference that we're seeing here, according to interviews that I've read in the media and anecdotal reporting, is that a lot of the people who are coming now are simply fleeing Putin's mobilization order. They are young people, mainly young men, of course, but many with bringing their families or their girlfriends who can't bring their work with them. In fact, I've seen a lot of people interviewed who've said, no, I can't do my work by distance. Maybe they're an electrician, and many jobs you can't do by distance. So we're also seeing people saying that they're bringing their savings, but they've just brought everything they have and they know it won't last. They hope to find work in Kazakhstan, or they hope to move on, or they simply don't have a plan because they're just fleeing that mobilization order urgently.
Oh, wow. And I don't know what kind of impact it will have in the future, but what kind of impact it's already having now? Do you know?
Well, one of the impacts that we've seen is a massive rise in the price of rental accommodation in Kazakhstan, specifically in northern Kazakhstan. We did have a report that rental accommodation on the border with Russia has gone up by between 15 and 34% in one week because of the massive rise in demand. Now, that's created quite some disconcertment among Kazakh people who there's anecdotal evidence of them being thrown out of their apartments to make room for Russians who will pay more. So certainly that's one impact we're seeing. And that's led to a lot of discussion, of course, and debate on social media and among Kazakhs on the ground. And Grim, I wanted to ask you about that as well. I mean, what are you hearing from your friends, family and contacts in Kazakhstan about the reaction, or what are you reading on social media? How do people feel about all these Russians arriving in Kazakhstan?
Well, there is quite a mix of feelings, and I think that I would say majority understand the current situation and they try to help. But there are also people who are very unhappy that so many Russian citizens are coming, because definitely it's going to have some impact in terms of social, political, economic situation in the country. And not just in Kazakhstan, but in other Central Asian countries. I know my friend in Bishkek was also saying that some of her friends were kicked out of their apartments because Russian citizens were willing to pay twice more the price. So, of course, landlords would take this money. Some of my other friends, they are entrepreneurs and they're willing to provide jobs for Russian citizens. And some people are quite happy that, let's say, IT specialists coming, doctors are coming. And some people are justifiably angry because they also know that the economic situation in the country is not great. And there are a lot of, especially like Russian men are coming. And some of the people on social media also reported that, for example, on Tinder, there were so many Russian citizens right now. So we don't know what will be the impact of this massive influx. But overall, I think that Kazakhstanis and other Central Asian nations are willing to help with their usual generosity and hospitality, even when the neighbor is not really bringing any benefits sometimes in terms of increasing rent prices and other political and economic escalation.
In terms of the reception that the Russians are getting, of course, we're seeing some people welcoming them and some people not. I mean, we've seen people protesting, in fact, about the arrival of Russians. A couple of young people were arrested at Almaty Airport. And sometimes people have been protesting about maybe what they perceive as chauvinistic attitudes as well from Russians towards Central Asians. But of course, we're also seeing reports of, the great tradition of Central Asian hospitality, people cooking food like plov and taking it to these kind of people who are fleeing their country.
Joanna, what about social media discussions? I'm sure you've seen some memes on social media about Russians coming to Central Asia. Do you know any of the examples that are worth mentioning?
Certainly there's been heated discussions on social media about all of this. And we, in fact, at the Eurasianet, we had last week, we had a very interesting newsletter about these memes that are circulating specifically relating to Kyrgyzstan. And, we're seeing a famous TikTok star doing some kind of turning the tables on some of the kind of racist comments that Kyrgyz migrant workers face in Russia, turning the tables and, making them about Russian people in Kyrgyzstan. can. So we have a newsletter on that. Subscribe to our newsletter to read it. And of course, in Kyrgyzstan, it's worth mentioning that one of the particularly sore points has been Russians coming in and calling the country Kyrgyzia. It's a sort of old colonial name that doesn't please many Kyrgyz people, and being asked to call, please call our country Kyrgyzstan, or its proper name, or the Kyrgyz Republic, but not Kyrgyzia. And in addition, I think worth mentioning is our correspondent mentioned in her newsletter how she met a Russian in Bishkek and asked him to pronounce Rahmat correctly in Kyrgyz. And he said it was all the same to him, whether it was Rahmat or Rahmet, meaning thank you, because to him, Kyrgyz and Kazakh were one language. And I think that's the kind of colonial attitude that people are complaining about, that some people are encountering.
Yeah, definitely. There is a lot of discussions about the imperial colonial attitude, and it's a big topic that we will probably touch upon later on as well, many times. But also I wanted to add that there was on social media in Kazakhstan some kind of a joke: how do you recognize Russian from Russia, or Russian from Kazakhstan, is when Russian from Russia would say tenge instead of tenge with air, and that's how you recognize them. And so it's quite funny. They made a lot of videos about this as well on social media. Joanna, how is the government reacting, particularly in Kazakhstan? We've seen quite a few statements from Tokayev and other government officials, and in other Central Asian countries. What is the reaction?
The government in Kazakhstan has been at pains to try and assuage people's concerns, partly. Certainly ministers keep saying that they understand that rents are rising, but they've asked, they've reminded people of their rights, and they've also promised to kind of try to stabilize the housing market. Although, to be honest, they're a bit short on concrete ideas, or at least they haven't made them public. And they've also tried to calm people's fears that this will fuel inflation and so on. But I think particularly interesting has been the reaction of President Kasym-Jomart Tokayev in Kazakhstan. He made a speech in which he talked about how Kazakhstan should take care of these arriving Russians, how they are fleeing what he described as a hopeless or desperate situation, and how Kazakhstan needs to take care of them. People need to remember their traditions of sort of hospitality, solidarity. He even quoted a Kazakh proverb saying that good relations with neighbors are the guarantee of peace and quiet. But he also said he would be talking to the Russians about this situation. Now, we don't know what that means exactly, or what he wants to say to them, or what solutions he's looking for. Also interesting was a comment by the justice minister saying that Russians fleeing conscription are not subject to detention in Kazakhstan, that there are no legal grounds, at least at this point, to detain Russians who are fleeing conscription. He said that Kazakhstan has extradition treaties with Russia and would abide by those, but people fleeing conscription do not fall under those provisions. So Kazakhstan trying to make these people welcome and show sympathy on the official level. Of course, that should be put in the context of the president's general attitude towards the war, which has been that Russia is an ally. They do not criticize openly, but neither has Kazakhstan shown, I think, the support that Russia wanted from its ally, and has been at pains to say recently that it won't recognize the results of the so-called referendums in the breakaway territories of Ukraine. I think the influx of Russians has put Kazakhstan again in an awkward position with regard to its neighbour. President Tokayev trying to handle this in a sort of measured manner.
And now we're moving to the topic of Kyrgyzstan-Tajikistan border issue, and our Central Asia editor Peter Leonard will tell us more in detail what's going on there.
Hello, Igorim and Joanna. It's a pleasure to join you on this second episode of this fantastic new podcast.
Thank you, Peter. Would you please recap for us, briefly, what happened between Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan and where we are now? And also, what did our correspondents find out when they went to study the situation report on the ground?
The fighting that took place between Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan was very bloody and unpleasant, although it was in chronological terms limited to only about 4 or 5 days. And so the last day of any serious clashes was September the 17th. What has happened since then essentially has sort of moved the drama into the political arena of the two respective countries, in that on September the 25th, the heads of the security services of Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan met to sign a protocol which committed both sides essentially to demilitarize these sensitive border areas. There are a number of points in the protocol, the most important one of which was to agree to withdraw border troops from 4 border sort of outposts. The main point in the protocol was a mutual commitment to withdraw troops from 4 border outposts apiece, so 4 in Tajikistan and 4 in Kyrgyzstan. And the idea there, according to the terms of the protocol, was that by not having troops actually in the most sensitive places where fighting has taken place, not just on this occasion but in previous times, that there will be a less of a likelihood of it occurring all over again. However, the agreement has been met has met a very hostile reaction in Kyrgyzstan in particular, where civil society is very vibrant, and unlike Tajikistan, people have much greater freedoms to express their positions. The unhappiness in Kyrgyzstan essentially stems from the idea that by not having Kyrgyz troops in some of these sensitive areas where Kyrgyz communities feel that over the decades Tajik communities have gradually encroached, sometimes it's not necessarily encroached in terms of living in these sort of spaces so much as using some sort of natural resources like forests and river and so on. And the fear is that by not having troops on the ground actually monitoring the situation, that opponents in Kyrgyzstan of this protocol argue that the Tajiks could kind of gradually sort of try and snatch away bits of territory over time.
So now that this protocol has been signed, I mean, what do you think are the prospects for these communities that are affected? I mean, will it allow them to live in peace?
Well, I mean, this is the question. Although the troops have been ostensibly drawn back from some of these sensitive areas, the broader dynamic we've seen over the years has been for both of these countries to increase their sort of militarization. Something that I note over and again is how in border conflicts in this area 20 years ago, let's say, if it was a question of villagers coming to clashes with sticks and stones, you know, the sticks and stones eventually became hunting rifles, and then it became border troops clashing with automatic rifles, and then automatic rifles became mortars, and now this latest round of fighting has seen the armies of the two sides using drones, using tanks, using heavy artillery, I mean, using very serious weaponry. So that has not changed. I mean, the protocol would ostensibly sort of addresses that issue, but the truth is that the kind of the momentum is going in a very troubling place. When you speak about the communities themselves, Kyrgyzstan is in a very difficult position here because demographically, the Batken region, Batken province, is far less populous than the neighboring province in Tajikistan. The economic prospects are, you know, Tajikistan is a poor country, but that particular part of Tajikistan certainly has more economic possibilities, whereas southwest corner of Kyrgyzstan is as remote as it's possible to get in Kyrgyzstan, and far away from sort of big residential kind of urban centers. And in that respect, the economic options that people who live there have are not great, and it is accordingly, you know, one scenario is that gradually people are going to be moving away, and this is what our correspondents have reported on in last week, an article which I would urge everyone to go and check out. an article which basically interviewed villagers in several kind of these conflict areas, you know, along a kind of a perimeter of 100 kilometers. And the views sort of vary. I mean, some villagers will tell you, you know, this is Kyrgyz land, it always has been, and they're going to stay there till the end. But, you know, a more kind of a sober position that one hears is that, you know, look, we just don't really have prospects here. We feel that our government isn't doing enough to protect us, and that therefore the time may have come to simply move away.
Thank you, Peter. Clearly, from what you've told us, the situation remains alarming, and we'll be continuing to follow it, report on it from the ground at EurasiaNet.
Joanna, I know that you've been to Chinese consulate in Almaty recently, where there was a protest of Xinjiang activists. What did you see there?
Indeed, I was at the Chinese consulate to watch the activists mark 600 days of protests on their part outside that consulate, because they've been going regularly to try and draw attention to the plight of their relatives who are in prison camps or in prisons in China. And this, as I say, they've been going regularly, and they count off the days, and it's been 600 days, so well over a year. In fact, it'll be coming up for 2 years soon. And what did I see? Well, the activists are usually in small numbers, and there was only around six of them. On that day, and they were holding up signs of their relatives' pictures, and each one stepped forward to recount the plight of that particular relative, what had happened to them, what charge they'd been jailed for, and so on, or whether they'd simply disappeared into the camps, as some people do. Terribly sad stories, people jailed for 20 years. One woman's elderly mother jailed for a long period because, according to her daughter, she was reading prayers. So that's what I saw at the consulate on that day. Police prevented the activists from approaching the consulate itself, but they were allowed to stand and hold up their signs and tell their stories for a while on the streets, although officials came to warn them that what they were doing was illegal. And in the past, they have gone and arrested them afterwards and charged them with illegal protests after the event. But I also want to ask you about this, Aigerim, because you've reported extensively with interviews, many, many interviews of people who've suffered because of all this. And could you tell us something about what people have told you over the years you've been reporting on this?
Yes, sure. As you said, it is incredibly sad stories of all these people who cannot see their loved ones behind closed borders. I know personally some of the protesters whose relatives were jailed for 20, 10 years for charges that are without any evidence. And we know that those people who are left in Xinjiang, who were undergoing political re-education camps, they also reported gross human rights violations. Women from Xinjiang told me that there were cases of forced sterilization, abortions. Some even mentioned rapes, but they're all afraid to speak about it publicly. And there are a number of other violations, and I think that the public should also still pay close attention to it. In our first episode, we reported about Xi Jinping's visit to Central Asia and China getting closer to Central Asia amid a Russian invasion into Ukraine. And I think this is important context to remember, given that Kazakhstan is again in a very awkward position, trying to somehow protect ethnic Kazakhs in Xinjiang, but also try not to anger its neighbor. And because of that, I think we've seen lots of detentions, arrests of the Xinjiang activists in Kazakhstan. Some of them got asylum abroad in Sweden, in the US, and now they are protesting abroad as well. And I think with China getting closer to Central Asia, it might mean that Xinjiang activism in Kazakhstan would finally be forgotten or severely restricted.
I agree with you, Agamem. I think we've seen over recent years, we've definitely seen more and more restrictions on that activism, which was very intense at one point. And, you know, now we're just seeing a few activists trying to continue to raise that point. And I do think that, you know, the fact that China has become even more important for the Central Asian countries, for Kazakhstan specifically, because, as you mentioned, because of Russia's war in Ukraine, is going to make the Kazakh government even more reluctant to talk about that in any meaningful way.
Thank you, Joanna, for your inputs. I agree that the situation with Xinjiang activism in Kazakhstan and in Central Asia looks quite grim. And if our listeners are interested to know more about all these issues, you can visit our website, Eurasianet, and subscribe to our newsletters and our podcast. This has been the Eurasia Chat podcast with your hosts Aygerim Toluhanova and
Joanna Lillis.
Subscribe at Eurasianet, Spotify, Apple Music, and other platforms. Thank you for listening, and be sure to tune in to our next episode.